Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Hello, welcome to this week's Little Atoms, with me, Neil Denny, and I'm talking to the science writer, Brian Sweetek. Brian Sweetek is a science writer and research associate at the New Jersey State Museum. He writes the blog Laylaps for Wired Science and Dinosaur Tracking for Smithsonian. He's been a guest on BBC Radio 4's Material World and has written for The Times and The Guardian, as well as The Wall Street Journal and Scientific American. Brian is the author of Written in Stone, The Hidden Secrets of Fossils and the Story of Life on Earth. And that's what we talk about in tonight's interview. So I'm joined today by Brian Sweetek. So Brian, thanks for speaking to Little Atoms today.
I'm glad to be here.
So we're going to be talking about your book, Written in Stone. Let's begin by going right back to the beginnings of paleontology as a discipline. The first discoveries of fossils and the beginnings of our understandings of what they are. This was obviously happening against the backdrop of Christianity and the Christian ideas of creation and the Christian ideas of the age of the earth. So perhaps we could talk a little bit about the difficulties that threw up as well.
Sure. People have known about fossils for a very long time. I mean, there's influences going back all throughout Greek and Roman mythology, all these myths and legends. There's a historian named Adrian Mayer who's done a lot of really excellent work in books like The First Fossil Hunters, sort of looking at myths like the Cyclops and Griffins and tracing those to fossils. It looks like, for example, that the myth of the Cyclops has something to do with the fossils of dwarfed elephants that lived on islands in the Mediterranean until, relatively recently, a few thousand years ago. And when you look at an elephant skull, it's got this big hole right in the middle. It looks like an eye should belong there. It really doesn't. That's the whole thing. The nose, the eyes are to the side. But if you didn't know anything about elephant anatomy, you'd assume that this was the skull of some giant one-eyed beast. So, and it probably goes even further back than that. So people have been finding fossils and wondering about fossils for a very long time, but they didn't really understand what they were until about the 17th century or so. And the person who really made the major difference and this was a guy named Nicholas Steno, and he was a Danish anatomist and naturalist. He did a lot of different scientific studies before eventually leaving all that behind to join the Catholic Church. But what really made the difference for him was he saw the head of a great white shark. He was dissecting it in this anatomical theater, back before movies and blogs and everything else. This was, a really entertaining way to spend an afternoon, was to go see someone cut open a rotting shark head. So as he's peeling back all these layers and looking at it, he looks at the teeth of this great white shark, and he says, that looks kind of familiar, because people have been picking up these brown triangular stones with serrated edges in the hillsides that were fossilized shark teeth, but they just didn't know it at the time. They thought, that these things grew inside the earth, or they fell from the moon, or had some other cause. It was sort of the earth trying to imitate nature. But Steno thought otherwise. He thought, it's obviously a shark's tooth, so we have only a couple of options here. Either the land was once covered by an ocean, and sharks were swimming around and left the teeth on the bottom, and the water receded, and that's why you find shark teeth out on the hillside far away from the ocean. Or the land got lifted up after being covered by the sea. So at some point or another, sharks are swimming around, or what is now land, whichever process you choose, it's kind of hard to decide which was actually the case, whether the land was brought up or the sea went down. But the world had changed, and this was a major idea. I mean, a few people had sort of stumbled across this realization before, but no one had really done anything with it. And Steno was the first one to sort of bring this to other naturalists, other savants of his day, and start the discussion. I mean, not everyone believed him. It was still a pretty contentious idea that the world was once different than it is now, and the geology could change, that the earth wasn't just static sort of since the time of creation or since the time of first life, at least. So this sort of started this discussion, about how can you tell whether these things are really living or not? And it's really sort of like the microstructure of things like fossil shells. If you look at the shells, you can see growth lines in them. You know, if the Earth was just sort of reproducing shell-like structures, you wouldn't expect to see signs of growth, signs of something organic inside. So Steno sort of got the ball rolling, but it was other naturalists elsewhere in Europe who started to pick up after that. And vertebrate paleontology itself, the focus of Britain and Stone, really kicked off with Charles Cuvier in France. When he was only, I think, about 26 when he started delivering some of his major papers at the end of the 1700s. I think it was 1796 when he delivered his paper on fossil mammoths and saying, look, we have living African and Asian elephants. We've got this thing that people are calling a mammoth from Siberia. You have all these bones that the Americans are saying is, this incognitum or this weird elephant-like beast. The fossil species don't match the living species. They're not around anymore. And given the age of exploration, we said, chances are that they aren't hiding somewhere. They're not in some jungle or off on some, distant plain or something like that. Life has changed. Life is if species go extinct, the world changes. There are, these revolutions that happen to wipe away these past worlds, and that really got things going in terms of scientists looking at what the past history of the world was like. It started becoming irrefutable. We weren't talking about just shells or shark teeth anymore. You had mammoths, mastodons, giant ground sloths, mosasaurs, these giant seagoing lizards that looked like sort of Komodo dragons on steroids but with fins and legs. There wasn't anything like that at all, so it couldn't be denied anymore.
Well, you talk about the idea of those species going extinct, but I wasn't aware to the extent until I read the book that just that idea of species being able to become extinct was denied because, it was the religious orthodoxy would not allow the idea that God would allow species to die out.
Well, right. It's this idea of the great chain of being, which sort of came about in the Middle Ages and stayed popular for a number of centuries, and in that sort of God ordered all of nature from the tiniest mineral speck all the way through us. Our species was supposed to represent sort of the top of the animal creation, where we had a soul, but we were still given to animal urges, maybe to angels, and everything all the way up to God himself. And within that, there couldn't be any gaps, and there couldn't be any change. If you lost one species, then the whole order of nature would be entirely thrown off. And, why would God create an animal and then just let it suddenly disappear? It didn't make any sense to anybody. And even people who were, deists or didn't have the same sort of narrow version of Christian orthodoxy. You had people like Thomas Jefferson who denied that extinction happened for most of his life. He came to accept it later on, but during his days when he was writing things like Notes on the State of Virginia, he denied that extinction happened. He thought there were still mastodons running around the American West. He told Lewis and Clark to be on the lookout for these things when he later sent them to go exploring. This was something that people just couldn't accept. Why would God or nature or whatever supernatural force you care to name, create something and then let it be destroyed? People just couldn't wrap their heads around that until the beginning of the 19th century almost.
The other thing that's central here is the growing realization of the antiquity of the Earth. And you, all the way through the book, one of the people that features regularly is Charles Lyell, who popularized the idea of a sort of ongoing, gradual geological change. So let's talk a little bit about that sort of battle of geologists to decide, how the Earth actually changed.
Right. I mean, until relatively recently, until the early 20th century, you didn't really have a good way of understanding how old the Earth actually is. Radiometric dating, where you take a radioactive compound and you see how slowly it degrades into this stable daughter element. Using that kind of technique, that required an understanding of radioactivity and all these complicated tests. So it's really only been about 100 years, even a little bit less, that we've been able to even do anything like that and start to get an understanding of absolute age. And before that, when you had people like William Smith in England and even a number of French naturalists in the early 1800s, looking at just the layering of rocks, you'd see certain fossils that occurred in some layers and not in others. The extinction of species and species turnover actually allowed sort of the organization of geologic time, because you could look in a certain layer and say, okay, the species of ammonite occurs in this layer and nowhere else. So if you find the species, you know you're here in time. In the layer above it, there's a different species. So this allowed a sort of correlation through fossils, and today we can put both together and say, okay, well, we know we're in this general layer because we have this fossil in it. If there's radioactive material in it or some way to date it in absolute sense, you can get an age for that, so it's a combined approach. But for a while, just even understanding how old the Earth is was a seemingly insurmountable task. How do you calculate that? How do you get an understanding of it? You can say it's old, and you can say, it must have been going on for thousands, if not millions of years for all these changes to accumulate and occur. But initially, there's this sort of battle for an understanding that the Earth actually did change, that mountains did rise and then erode again, and there's this ongoing process of change. And there was a debate for a while, you mentioned Charles Lyell, between people who thought that most change occurred in just really rapid, catastrophic ways. Things would be relatively stable, then something would come along and sort of wipe all that away, usher in the new era that would remain relatively stable, and so on and so forth through the cycling. And then people like Lyell, who thought, well, the Earth is constantly changing in these very minute ways, and it sort of evens out altogether. So if one mountain range rises, another one falls into the sea, so everything sort of stays more or less. It's a constant sort of dynamic equilibrium in a way. And now that dichotomy isn't quite right, that you have constant gradual change, as Lyell was advocating, but you also have catastrophic, very rapid events that can change the landscape very, very quickly, and things that we had no idea could happen at all until the 1990s, when there's the major debate over the asteroid strike that punctuated the end of the Cretaceous, probably triggered the extinction that wiped out the non-avian dinosaurs. No one really considered seriously or had any major evidence for the idea that asteroids occasionally struck Earth and could have a major effect on the history of life on Earth. We sort of need to see it or need some evidence before we can even consider something like that. So, it was cast as the uniformitarian versus catastrophist debate. That's basically over. It's been over for a long time. But early on, it's relatively important because, depending on your view, the Earth either was constantly changing or is sort of going through these periods of devastation and reform over and over again.
I want to take us now in the direction of talking about how fossils and paleontology have helped shed light on evolution. And in the beginning of the book, in the introduction, you quote Richard Dawkins saying that we may be just as well off of our understanding of evolution if not one single fossil had ever been found. And you sort of take a bit of exception to this. So I want to spend a bit of time talking about how paleontology helps us to understand evolution. So first of all, let's talk about this. There's this idea that always bedevils any talk of fossils, and this is the idea of the transitional fossils, or more popularly, the missing link. And I was interested in the book, you talk about this very concept of the missing link as also being something that really has its roots in theology and the idea of the great chain of being that you mentioned earlier.
It's sort of a holdover from that, the exact origins of the phrase of, trying to find where, people start using the phrase missing link, but it really has ties to this idea that you have this graded chain and everything sort of goes in a straight line. It progresses from lower to higher, and that's been one of the sort of classic bugbears of evolutionary changes that, for a while, at least early on, and especially when people were worried about sort of the theological implications of evolution, they at least wanted something to say, okay, well, it's changing, but it's moving upwards towards us. It's a relatively straight pathway, and everything's relatively constrained. It's not chaotic. Chance has a very small role to play. It's all very orderly. And that sort of imagery, I think, is kind of insidious, and it still sticks around a lot of diagrams today. One of the most famous ones, it was created for a book called Early Man, I think, in the 1970s. It sort of showed this progression of humans from like a gibbon-like ancestor through all the fossil hominins that were known at the time to us, just walking in a straight line. The text, made it clear that some of these were different branches that didn't lead to us. They're more cousins than anything else. But the imagery was that we're on the straight pathway towards constant improvement and constant betterment, that there's some sort of trajectory to evolution, that we're meant to be here, that, we're on this, pathway where things are always getting better. And when you look at the fossil record itself, that's not the case at all. You have this constant branching out and paring back by a extinction, and chance has a pretty big role to play in it. And in addition to chance, the concept of contingency in terms of what has come before will influence what happens later. You know, during a mass extinction event, say, you know, the species that go extinct obviously will not leave any descendants. You won't have any modified forms from that. So the species that survive, those are sort of like the seed species that are going to set the stage for what comes next. So I don't see that sort of, you know, sort of hopeful trajectory that I think a lot of people find alluring or sort of want to see, because they'd like to believe that this whole thing has been planned out ahead of time. So I kind of bridle a little bit whenever I see people use the phrase missing link, because I think it really just invokes this sort of straight line, very simplistic imagery, and obscures how evolution really works. If you look at something like, you know, the evolution forces, it used to always be presented in a, you know, straight line. You know, something small, like this tiny, you know, almost cat-sized horse with multiple toes named Neohippus, you know, and the horses get bigger, their tooth crowns get larger, the number of toes become reduced. It's a very, you know, very simple diagram. But when you look at what we actually understand about the evolution, what people have understood for, you know, about 100 years now, this is understood relatively early on, that you can't slot all the horses into one straight line. It's this, you know, flowering of diversity, and then, you know, extinction, another flowering diversity, and extinction until we just have one species of horse left now, which is kind of unusual given the past history. It's the same thing with our species, where you had, you know, 3, 4, 5 species of human, you know, living alongside each other at any one time, and now there's just the one. And I think understanding that process, understanding that pattern, really provides a context for, you know, how the world came to be as it is today. You know, how can we understand where we came from without understanding that pattern?
You look in the book at the example of how limbs developed, specifically in how the first sort of ancestors of fish came out of the water and onto the land. And you look at the example of the lungfish, and I think this is it sort of illustrates what you've just said in the idea of almost a need to put a narrative onto nature in terms of the direction that the evolutionary development was going. So let's talk a little bit about this example of the lungfish.
Right. Well, for a while, and this is the image that, you know, I was always presented with, and was one of the inspirations for writing this book, because I know the story changed so much, was that, you know, many, many millions of years ago, like well over, you know, 350 million years ago, you had, you know, life was mainly constrained to the swamps. You didn't even have that many vertebrates on land yet, so really any at all. So the ancestors of the land-dwelling vertebrates were fish. This is pretty much agreed upon, finding these proper species with the transitional features that would explain how this occurred, you know, hadn't been found yet. So you had, you know, early amphibious creatures on one side and fish on the other, and not very much in between. So what was proposed was, on the basis of lungfish, which are, you know, among our closest living fish relatives, is that you had these lungfish-like creatures that were sort of crawling out onto land in the dry season as their swamps or their pools sort of evaporated and disappeared, you know, in the search for more water. So you had these, you know, brave little fish trekking over the baking mud flats in the search of another little pool. And the ones that were better at finding the next place to go, or had the variations that allowed them to carry themselves over the land more efficiently, were the ones who sort of set up this transition. So it was like the little fish that could sort of story of early tetrapod evolution, where there's this need to develop legs or else go extinct. You know, it wasn't the sort of Lamarckian idea of, you know, if there's some need or you know, if they're using their fins enough, it'll just sort of happen. You know, if people understood in terms of natural selection, you know, variations allowing some fish to go further than others, and therefore those fish reproduce and then go to the next generation. But still, you have this grand narrative, this sort of heroic story about, you know, our early fish ancestors. Now we know that's not true at all, thanks to discoveries like Tiktaalik from the Arctic and Ichthyostega and Akamtsaga from Greenland. We know that limbs didn't develop on land. They developed in the water. That's the really strange thing about this, is that, you know, these animals were living in swamps. They weren't being driven out of their homes by drought or by seasonal fluctuation. Limbs and fingers developed to move around in the water first, and that sort of opened up the possibility that, you know, species could later come out onto land. So we kind of had the whole thing backwards, but we didn't really know it until people started finding these creatures with transitional features.
You're listening to Little Atoms this week with me, Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Brian Sweetek about his book Written in Stone. So next, Brian, I'd like to talk a little bit about birds. And I was quite surprised at the idea that it's common now that birds evolved from dinosaurs had been around for quite a long time. Indeed, T.H. Huxley thought it was the case. But subsequently after that, there was various ups and downs of this story where people changed their mind back now to the point where we know for sure that birds definitely did evolve from dinosaurs. So let's talk a little bit about this journey.
Sure. Well, you mentioned, you know, Huxley is one of my scientific heroes. Actually, the first academic paper I've ever written, I wrote about his ideas about the bird-dinosaur relationship. And he didn't so much say that birds evolved from dinosaurs as something dinosaur-like. Huxley did some peculiar ideas about the way geologic time worked for a lot of his career. He thought that a lot of major evolutionary change happened during what he called non-geologic time, sort of this period of ancient time where there's no fossil record to speak of. So when we look at the fossil record itself, we're looking at sort of the persistent forms from those early evolutionary transitions. It's a sort of weird concept to think about today, but that, you know, you're sort of looking at almost like the leftovers or sort of these forms that sort of stagnated after those initial changes. But on anatomical grounds, because he's chiefly an anatomist, he recognized early on in the, you know, 1860s that, you know, birds and reptiles are very, very similar. And then when people started finding really exquisite dinosaur skeletons, so, you know, that looks like it fits. It looks like a good precursor for birds. There's a dinosaur from Germany called the Compsognathus. It's from 1861 in particular, that at one point he said, if you put feathers on this thing, you wouldn't really hesitate to call it, you know, a bird ancestor. So for him, that was like the perfect form from which to derive birds. But he didn't think they immediately started flying, and this is the sort of twist that I think a lot of people have missed, is that in the same year that Compsognathus was found, you had the first skeleton of Archaeopteryx, which has, you know, traditionally been thought to be the first bird, found the same sort of quarries. And there's a lot of controversy about this, and people like the English anatomist Richard Owen said this is the first bird, and, you know, it seemed to be this wonderful confirmation of evolution that you had this thing with reptilian traits and avian traits together, you know, a dinosaur-like body with feathers on it. But Huxley thought it was sort of like this oddball side branch, because he thought the transition went something like Compsognathus, something flightless bird like an ostrich, and then flying birds. So for him, Archaeopteryx is way too early. So in his scientific description of it, you'd think that he would sort of celebrate this thing as a wonderful transitional form, but he kind of pushes it off to the side because he had this very different vision of how things worked. But regardless of what he actually thought, he really popularized the idea that there's some kind of essential connection between birds and dinosaurs, or at least something dinosaur-like. And a lot of people sort of ran with that afterwards. But there weren't any more fossils to really fill in the transition. You had, you know, Archaeopteryx sort of as a linchpin, this, you know, the start of something, but nothing to connect it to what its ancestors actually were. It was sort of sitting in this wide gap between birds and whatever their actual ancestors were, and for a while people preferred the idea that, well, you know, the resemblances between birds and dinosaurs, between birds and dinosaurs and pterosaurs, those are all just instances of convergence. This was just all independent evolutionary action. All the traits that they shared together had arisen independently, and they all were derived from this sort of bipedal crocodile-like ancestor. But then, especially in the 1960s, you had people like John Ostrom from Yale University finding dinosaurs like Deinonychus, you know, the sort of inspiration for the raptors of Jurassic Park. And they were exceptionally bird-like, and they were exceptionally like Archaeopteryx. You know, Archaeopteryx always kind of looked like an oddball dinosaur with feathers. It's just no one had ever really found any other ones to sort of confirm that. So discoveries like Deinonychus got paleontologists thinking about that again, that idea started to pick up steam. And then finally, in 1996, the sort of floodgates started to open. You know, these fossils from China, places like Liaoning, from the late Jurassic, and throughout the Cretaceous, these feathered dinosaurs, you know, with not only feathers, but a variety of feathers. You have ones that have wispy fuzz. You have ones that have these quill-like sort of feathers. You have ones that have full flight feathers on them. So as paleontologists have learned more about dinosaurs and the image of dinosaurs has changed, especially since the 1970s, a lot of traits that we thought were unique to birds showed up in dinosaurs first. It's not even, as I was saying before, a matter of just this one straight line transition where all the features became acquired at once during this little change. It's things like feathers, nesting behavior, air sacs in the skeletons, which we thought was a unique bird trait. They're widely distributed through dinosaurs. So a lot of the traits that we think make a bird are very, very, very ancient, and our understanding continues to change. It was a kind of a bizarre experience a few weeks ago in that there's only one Archaeopteryx specimen that's in North America. It's in the middle of nowhere. It's in this place called Thermopolis, or the Wyoming Dinosaur Center in Thermopolis, Wyoming. So I was doing some work with some field crews in Montana, and I figured on my way back down to Utah, I'd take a stop there. And about 2 hours before I got to the museum, I checked my email, and I saw a news alert that there was a paper in Nature that very day that had just come out about how Archaeopteryx might not actually be the first bird at all. It might just be another feathered dinosaur. We just always thought it was the first bird because we didn't really have very much to compare it to. You know, all these avian traits that we now see are widely distributed amongst dinosaurs. So there's so many of them that it's kind of almost difficult to nail down where dinosaurs stop and birds begin, and that's why paleontologists now kind of insist on people calling birds living dinosaurs, because they're the one group that has survived. So, you know, even though it was a little bit sort of frustrating to have this fossil demoted before I get to see it, I think it speaks to the level of understanding we've been able to achieve.
You mentioned the remarkable fact that a lot of dinosaurs would have had feathers. Recently, particularly because of the fact that they're feathers, we've been able to work out what colour those feathers were. So tell us how that works.
Yeah, that's a relatively recent discovery. It's something that, you know, I find really exciting, because just about every book that I read as a kid said that, you know, we can never tell what colour dinosaurs were. It's entirely speculative. But now we have a way to do that. So if you were to take a feather off a living bird or a modern bird, and you were to zoom in, you know, to a very high degree level of resolution, get, you know, really down to the structure of the feather, you'd see all these sort of blob-like structures called melanosomes. These are pigment-carrying bodies that are they're in the feather, and they help give feathers their colors. And they don't do all colors. Some colors are chemical, like a lot of oranges and blues. But things like, you know, red and black and sort of colors and gray as well. They are created, at least in part, by the distribution of these little bodies on the feathers. So what happened was a graduate student who was at Yale, I think he has his doctorate now, is moving to a different university, named Jacob Winther. He was looking at the ink sac of a fossil squid, and he saw these structures, and it kind of gave him the idea that, you know, maybe I should look for these elsewhere. What about, you know, fossilized feathers? So that's what he did, and that's what he and his colleagues have found, is that if you can use, like, scanning electron microscopes, or these really powerful microscopes, and really zoom in there on exquisitely preserved specimens, you can see the melanosomes of dinosaurs that have been dead for over 65 million years. And by looking at the distribution of those little bodies, you can get an idea of what color they actually were. So what the dinosaur his team worked on is called Anchiornis. It's sort of this Archaeopteryx-like feathered dinosaur from China. It's full flight feathers and the whole deal. And it had it was black and white, sort of almost like a magpie, but not quite. And the sort of splash of bright red feathers on the top of its head. And they figured this out by sampling feathers from different parts of its body. So by using this kind of technique now, at least for feathered dinosaurs, we can sort of get some kind of understanding of what the dinosaurian palate was like, and maybe tell us something about their biology. I mean, they just looked at one specimen, but if you do this multiple times for multiple specimens, you can see, okay, is there a color difference between males and females? Is there a color difference between individuals? What's the the variation like? So through this relatively simple technique, we can finally get at some of these long-running questions about dinosaur biology that otherwise we wouldn't be able to answer.
I want to look a little bit now about the... You talk in the book about the rise of mammals and the sort of constant warring battle between the rise of mammals and the rise of reptiles and going through the rise of dinosaurs and mammals basically surviving numerous mass extinctions. And particularly, you talk about what's possibly the worst ever mass extinction event that happened in the Permian era. Tell us briefly what we think happened then.
Yeah, so about 250 million years ago, a little bit prior to that, the world underwent the worst mass extinction of all time. I mean, people like Michael Benton have called this, when life nearly died, where, depending on which metric you're using, over 75%, perhaps even as high as 95% or so of known fossil species just disappear. There are different hypotheses as to why this extinction happened, but it seems to be related to a major change in the composition of the atmosphere, that greenhouse gases, in particular carbon dioxide, went way up, and oxygen went way down. So for animals that are air breathing, it would be like taking the elevator to the top of Mount Everest without having any time to sort of acclimate. It wasn't quite that rapid, but it was rapid enough that it changed the composition of the gases in the atmosphere. The oceans became very acidic. It was this major environmental crisis, probably at least partly attributable to massive volcanic eruptions, perhaps the release of methane pockets or greenhouse gas pockets in the ocean. But whatever actually happened, whatever the actual trigger was, it's pretty clear that the composition of the atmosphere changed dramatically. And prior to this, our own cousins and ancestors were pretty much running the show in terms of vertebrate life on land. This group called the synapsids that we're a part of, this diverse group, lots of weird stuff. People used to call them the mammal-like reptiles because they looked sort of funky and reptilian, but they're actually much more closely related to us than a reptile. They're all over the place. They're the dominant vertebrates in a lot of ecosystems, and they get hit pretty hard. Only a few lineages survive, and that small contingent formed the basis of what would eventually become the first mammals during the time of the dinosaurs. So after the Permian, you have the Triassic period. And the Triassic is this kind of odd time. It's a mixed up time. You have all, your remaining lineages from the Permian. You have new lineages coming in, the ancestors of dinosaurs, things more closely related to crocodiles. And they're all sort of mixed up together in these ecologies, and there's no clear front runner per se. I mean, it's only at the end that dinosaurs really become dominant. Mammals aren't around yet. True mammals don't evolve until a little bit later. But it's the sort of recovery period where all these surviving lineages trying to radiate and adapt and form the basis for sort of that great three era, Mesozoic range, the Triassic, Jurassic, Cretaceous that we identify with dinosaurs. So this is one of the major events in the history of life where you have this group, the synapses, they're doing well, doing successful, and other groups as well. And they just almost get entirely wiped out. It's almost as close the Earth has ever gotten to having its redo from start button pressed in terms of evolution.
So from then, there's another 150 million years in which the big dinosaurs basically rule the Earth. 65 million years ago, there's another mass extinction event. What people will be familiar with, an asteroid hits the Yucatan Peninsula and pretty much wipes out the dinosaurs. In the book, there's like a little bit of speculation towards the end about people that have sort of speculated about what might have happened if this event hadn't taken place, because we are literally talking about the possibility of an asteroid not hitting the Earth, and things would have been very different.
That's right. Yeah, people have sort of wondered, especially in terms of dinosaurs, something that's come up quite a bit. What if the non-avian dinosaurs had survived? I mean, they're already birds. So, those the avian dinosaurs, we know they survived, but what about all the other kinds, the kind of like Triceratops and Tyrannosaurus and all of those from the museums? And, chances are life on Earth would be very different. There's really no indication or reason to believe that, they would have just gone extinct, you know, in the next million years or so anyway, and life would have proceeded along this particular trajectory. This is what Stephen Jay Gould wrote about in A Wonderful Life, that if you could replay the tape of Earth history, you wouldn't expect things to be exactly the same. And I think a lot of the speculation about what would have happened, especially to the dinosaurs, has been sort of informed by wishful thinking or even supernatural or religious beliefs. So this idea that, you know, our species, you know, at least humans in particular, would have to evolve at some time. We were planned. We had to show up. So you had this thought experiment that was organized by a paleontologist named Dale Russell called the Dinosauroid, where he basically took something akin to the raptors of Jurassic Park, something called a troodon, and sort of molded it into human form and said, okay, well, you know, the dinosaurs hadn't gone extinct. They're obviously relatively smart dinosaurs. They have big eyes. They have three clawed hands. You know, probably they would have evolved into something like us. That's pretty much pure fantasy. There's no reason to believe that whatsoever. It's just sort of underscoring our own sort of self-importance or belief that we had to be here. And if, like I was mentioning before about the patterns of evolution in these mass extinctions, there's really no reason to believe that's true. If the asteroid didn't hit or the extinction of the non-avian dinosaurs was canceled, the world would probably be very different right now. I don't know if there would still be dinosaurs around today. I mean, 65 million years is a long time, and there were mass extinctions of mammals during that time that have obviously changed the way life on Earth is today. But I don't see anything at all to suggest that we'd still be here.
Or there would be some humanoid dinosaur, intelligent dinosaur, working in offices and driving cars.
That's right. I mean, if you look at our species, something like us has only evolved once in the entire history of life on Earth. There's only been one species like us. I mean, like is a relatively rough term. I mean, you have other primates, but something at our level of intelligence and you know, our ability to manipulate the environment. Just one time, we're the only species of our kind left. We're the only hominin left on Earth after, you know, this 6 million years of multiple species living alongside one another. If you looked at the history of life on Earth and you saw this cycle of you know, humanoid species showing up over and over again, I'd say, okay, there's something there. Something's going on that's causing the convergent evolution of this kind of organism over and over again. But you don't. I mean, in the entire, you know, over 3 billion-year history of life on Earth, there's just us once in relatively recent history, and we're almost on our way out by our own hands. So I don't know if to me, there's no indication that we have to be here at all.
Well, we're quickly running out of time, but just before we go, you're off at the weekend into the field to New Mexico to search for Triassic dinosaurs. Tell us what you're hoping to find. What sort of things happen when you're out on a dig?
Well, the place I'm headed out to is called Ghost Ranch. It used to be where the artist George O'Keefe lived for a time. It's in New Mexico. If you've seen the trailer for Cowboys and Aliens, that's the setting. It's filmed in that vicinity. And I'm going out there with the University of Utah paleontology crew, and what we're looking for is dinosaurs and other creatures from the time when dinosaurs were really just becoming dominant, where this big changeover in sort of the makeup of local ecosystems was happening. So you have, you know, these small predatory dinosaurs, things like Coelophysis, was recently discovered one named Tawa, living alongside these crocodile relatives that were also standing up right and running around, things like Ephigia that sort of convergently evolved a dinosaur body plan. So this sort of odd mix of creatures all living alongside one another, in this sort of critical turnover point in the history of life. And Ghost Ranch is actually relatively cushy compared to sort of the image of a lot of other field sites. There's, you know, running water, there are showers. We have facilities inside where we can prep fossils pretty much right after we find them. This isn't like going out to Mongolia where you have to, you know, plan for 6 months of car troubles, you know, when you go out there. So this is a relatively easy one. But, you know, it's hard work. You get up in the morning, you work out in the hot sun all day, you know, hoping to find something. You know, half of it's planning ahead, you know, knowing where to look, and half of it's just luck. You never really know what you're going to find. But hopefully the continued excavations will provide us a little bit of a better idea about what was living there at this time and how they all relate to each other before, during the time just before you started to get the really big dinosaurs, and dinosaurs, sort of the popular phrase, started to rule the Earth.
So I've been talking to Brian Sweetek about his book Written in Stone, The Hidden Secrets of Fossils and the Story of Life on Earth, which is out now from Icon Books. Brian, thanks for speaking to Little Atoms today.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.